Hello, this is Atah Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, December 10th, 2024. Coming to you from my home studio, we start on the front page. Together Decatur Guild helps music play. 50-year-old group supports education, symphony orchestra. This article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. As a music teacher at St. Teresa High School, Colleen Hillier-Pacey is grateful to those who can get musical instruments into the hands of her students. I really like to understand why kids like to learn, then see the results of it, she said. Help has come by way of the Symphony Orchestra Guild of Decatur. Through the Guild's scholarships and instrument loans, a few of Hillier-Pacey's students have been able to participate in the music programs. Others have gone on to compete in Illinois state competitions. The Symphony Orchestra Guild of Decatur, a 501c3 nonprofit organization aimed at providing support for Millikan, Decatur Symphony Orchestra celebrated its 50th anniversary this year. Ronald Gregory was the orchestra's conductor in 1973. He encouraged several community members to form the guild a year later, according to the guild's history. Although the membership once grew to 400, it has current membership of approximately 200. Bruce Campbell was one of the original Guild board members, serving as its third president. The board was made up of less than 10 people when it started. There was a small nucleus of people that found something good could come from working with the university, Campbell said. Most of the people had their own talent or a strong interest in music. The guild began because the first show drew small audiences, according to Campbell. It was a horrible shame that the orchestra would be playing and have so few people attend, he said. We were trying to formulate plans and get some kind of direction on how we might grow an audience and grow financial support for the orchestra. The board suggested they invite well-known musicians to perform, and the guild began raising money for this first endeavor. Guest artists included Benny Goodman, Carlos Montoya, Chet Atkins, and Edie Gourmet. Of course, we all had different kinds of personalities, Campbell said. It was an opportunity for people to become involved in a broader spectrum of music. Past president Sam Kershaw joined the board in 2000. The guild hosted several events to make money, including a short-lived community Christmas tree decorating competition held at the Decatur Civic Center, he said. Then we had the gala event, Kershaw said. Each year, the guild hosts a black tie event, complete with fine dining, music, and live and silent auctions. The guild has partnered with various programs to create more opportunities for the community. Along with concerts, the guild has contributed as a co-sponsor for the Decatur Youth Orchestra, sponsored youth scholarships and in-school programs, hosted university solo competitions, workshops, clinics, and master classes, and partnered with local schools' music programs. Adding education as a focus, Kershaw said that the guild had found its niche. That's because it's been very successful, he said. That became more of a focal point. This year, the Guild was able to raise approximately $75,000 for the orchestra and education programs. Mark Sorensen, current president of the Guild, said the funds help get the musical instruments into the hands of local students, as well as giving them opportunities to play. We lend out several hundred instruments each year to Decatur Public Schools students, Sorensen said, but our scholarships go to Decatur and Macon County students. There's a small sidebar here, hashtag Together Decatur. Do you know a person or of a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur? Well, if you do, contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983 or dbeckett@herald-review.com. Some small color photos here in this July 2018 file photo. Nolan Andrews, 8, of Decatur, learns about the violin from volunteers with the Symphony Orchestra Guild of Decatur. And the photo is taken of a close-up of his face and eyes looking at the bow. down the neck of the violin. Clay Jackson Herald and Review. Another small color photo, this one taken on the lake here in this August 2016 file photo. The Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra performs its 20th annual family concert on the lake. Lisa Morrison, Herald and Review, photo credit. National Weather Service always looking for the next big storm. Lincoln Weather Office provides crucial information across central Illinois. This article is by Matuzis Janik. Lincoln, whether there are torrential downpours, devastating winds from a tornado, or bone-chilling temperatures with piles of snow, the National Weather Service is there to ensure that residents are prepared and protected. We are primarily here for hazardous weather information, said Ed Shimon, warning coordination meteorologist at the NWS's Central Illinois Weather Forecast Office in Lincoln. When the weather turns hazardous, where people can be affected in their travel, their daily lives, possibly even loss of life and injury, we want to make sure that that information is disseminated as quickly as possible. The NWS's Lincoln office, located just off Illinois Route 10 next to the Logan County Airport, has been operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, since opening there in 1995. Shimon, who has been at the Lincoln site since April of 2005, said the office replaced existing locations in Springfield and Peoria and now comprises 23 staff members, including meteorologists, electronic technicians, and other support specialists. Lincoln's Doppler radar sits just outside the office on top of a 100-foot-high platform and covered by a fiberglass bubble. It runs 24 hours a day and is programmed with specific scan strategies that allow for quick updates during severe weather and a slower scan during calmer weather, Shimon said. The radar is one of 158 across the United States, Guam, and Puerto Rico. Illinois' other radar is in Chicago. Other nearby radars are in St. Louis, Davenport, Iowa, Paducah, Kentucky, and Indianapolis and Evansville, Indiana. Lincoln's radar also has been upgraded with dual polarization, which allows for three-dimensional visualizations of storm systems and objects that might be within them, like hailstones or debris that's been lofted into the air, Shimon said. Doppler radar is compiled into a processing system where meteorologists can view computer models, satellite information, weather observations, and more, Shimon said. Meteorologists can also sample the atmospheric air remotely via weather balloons launched twice a day at 5 a.m. and 5 p.m. Instruments attached to the balloons measure temperature and relative humidity, with the data being input to computer forecast models, Shimon explained. We're dedicated to making sure we utilize all the technology we can, and we train up on how to do that and leverage the models and the number of models that we have available in what we call ensembling, Shimon said. We're really focused into the future. If the weather is kind of in a lull, we're always looking for the next big storm. This winter, the office is expecting a high variability of temperature swings, with La Niña playing into the jet stream patterns and causing more moisture and warmer weather. Still, they do expect one or two highly impactful winter storms in the coming months, Shimon said. Meteorologist James Auten, who has worked at the Lincoln office since it opened in 1995, said he has seen the NWS's impact on public safety when they put out severe thunderstorm warnings and tornado warnings, which are more frequent in the summertime. He said one misconception is that the public has of the NWS is that they work at the television stations. However, he explained, the NWS is actually part of the United States government and is one government agency that is regarded highly from all sides of the political spectrum. That's our job, putting out the information and keeping the public safe, Auten said. When you find a job that you love, then you're really not working. There's been some rough times, some hard times, but we're still doing it to keep the public safe. Meteorologist Daryl Auten, who has worked at the Lincoln office since 2014, encourages the public to keep an eye on the NWS's website and social media, including the U.S. National Weather Service Central Illinois page on Facebook. where they keep people updated on what is happening and what they can expect in the days to come. The most important factor in the National Weather Service is protection of life and property, so we urge people to always stay safe out in the weather whenever possible, Anton said. Just keep an eye on severe weather, severe winds, severe thunderstorms, severe flash flooding, severe winter storms, and make sure to heed some of those slogans we have like, when thunder roars, go indoors, and turn around, don't drown. Meteorologist and science officer Andrew Taylor, who has been at the Lincoln office for over 3 years, said he loves learning about new technology and sharing it with his colleagues, making sure they can all use the tools necessary to do their jobs, and in some instances, make their jobs easier. Taylor said another aspect of the job is how the NWS interacts with partners at the local level, including municipalities, counties, and state departments. It's important to make sure they are all receiving the most up-to-date information to keep people safe. Something that I wasn't looking as much into when I was going into the Weather Service was that people aspect of the job, and I'd say that over time I've become just as interested in that as anything else, Taylor said. The National Weather Service is a trusted resource for information. Our meteorologists live in the local area, and they interact with our partners in the communities. Christopher Hogan, a student volunteer and graduate student studying geographic information science at Western Illinois University, said since starting at the NWS in late July, he's been able to shadow everyone at the office, which has helped him gain a better understanding and hands-on experience with meteorology. Hogan said his master's thesis will focus on the distance of storm events like tornadoes and if there's a correlation between the distance and timing of supercell tornadoes. He is working in collaboration with scientist and storm chaser Cameron Nixon's research, which looked at storm interactions and the correlation between where they are positioned. Nixon is well known for his storm chasing coverage on social media and works at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. Hogan said he is grateful for the opportunity to work at the NWS in Lincoln, and he hopes people realize that the work being done there is not as easy as just looking at a weather model for a forecast. The models are getting much better, and we rely on those, but you have to understand statistics, physical science, how to use those computers and technology, Hogan said. If people got to experience what we do, they'd understand that it's a lot more than just looking at a model and saying, that's going to happen, because you have to look at multiple different models and see which one has the biases and make your own forecast from there. It's a medium-sized color photo here. Caption reads, James Auten, a meteorologist at the National Weather Service's Central Illinois Weather Forecast Office in Lincoln, has been at the office since it opened in 1995. He is seen in this photo reviewing data on an advanced weather information processing system. And he has three screens at his in front of him at his desk, keyboard, mouse, phone, and then right next to him, another bank of multiple screens that are turned off. Clay Jackson, Lee Enterprises photo credit. And a very similar photo credit or photo here, but much larger, that leads off the story. Ed Shimone, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service Central Illinois Weather Forecast Office in Lincoln, looks at data from an advanced weather information processing system. Very similar setup with the monitors, keyboard, mouse, desk, etc. Clay Jackson photos, Lee Enterprises. And finally, a very interesting outdoor photo, medium-sized color. The National Weather Service Central Illinois Weather Forecast Office is just off Illinois Route 10 next to the Logan County Airport in Lincoln. And we're seeing some radar installations, a small outbuilding with a radar dome on top, and then next to it a structure with a radar dome on top. And while we're reading about the NWS, there's an interesting article here. NWS, bitter cold returning to area. Brendan Dennison, Lincoln. Cold weather is on its way back to central Illinois following a warm weekend in early December. The National Weather Service office in Lincoln said a cold front will move Monday across central Illinois, ushering in a colder air mass from Tuesday through Thursday. Scattered light snow showers or flurries are possible Wednesday afternoon with minor accumulation, NWS stated. According to NWS predictions, which are posted online at forecast.weather.gov, the chilling weather will make a resurgence by Tuesday after Sunday's high in Bloomington neared 60 degrees. Tuesday in Bloomington will see a daytime high close to 34 degrees, followed by a Wednesday high of 28. Tuesday night's low will be 21 degrees in the Twin Cities, and Wednesday night will chill down to 10 degrees. Indicator Tuesday's high will be near 36 degrees and drop to 23 degrees that evening. Wednesday indicator will warm up to 30 degrees at most, and that evening's temperature will dip to 10 degrees too. Mattoon will get a high Tuesday temperature of 38 degrees and a low of 23 degrees. Mattoon will see similar temperatures Wednesday compared to the two above municipal areas, with a high of 30 degrees and a low of 11 degrees in Mattoon. Temperatures will continue to decline through Thursday, with the Bloomington high topping out at 18 degrees and then lowering to 13 degrees that night. Decatur's high Thursday will be 21 degrees and the low freezing to 15 degrees. Mattoon will have a high of 22 degrees Thursday and a low of 15. NWS said Friday will bring milder temperatures to the region, with a chance of wintry mix changing to rain during the day and rain likely extending into the night. The high that day will be 36 degrees in Bloomington and 39 degrees in Decatur and Mattoon. So, front page business article, very interesting topic that I've been interested in. So here we go. Data centers bane for some communities. This article is by Dan Merica and Jesse Bedane, Associated Press, Alexandria, Virginia. The sprawling, windowless warehouses that hold rows of high-speed servers powering almost everything the world does on phones and computers are increasingly becoming fixtures of the American landscape, popping up in towns, cities, and suburbs across the United States. Demand for data centers ballooned in recent years because of the rapid growth of cloud computing and artificial intelligence, and urban and rural governments are competing for lucrative deals with big tech companies. But as data centers begin to move into more densely populated areas, abutting homes and schools, parks, and recreation areas, some residents are pushing back against the world's most powerful corporations over concerns about the economic, social, and environmental health of their communities. In Northern Virginia, more than 300 data centers dot the rolling hills of the area's westernmost counties and butt up against wooded bike trails winding through the suburbs. But one of the latest proposals in the area, Plaza 500, would see a 466,000-square-foot facility and adjacent electrical substation built a few hundred feet from townhomes, playgrounds, and a community center. The pitch from Starwood Capital Group, the private investment firm founded by billionaire Barry Sternlicht, to Fairfax County officials promised jobs and a significant property tax revenue boost. But data center critics say the incentives aren't enough to counteract the consequences of building the facilities close to homes. Tyler Ray, a leader in the fight against the Virginia Project, worries that more data centers in the area could compromise the already stressed power grid. More than 25% of all power produced in Virginia in 2023 went to data centers, a figure that could rise as high as 46% by 2030 if data center growth continues at its current pace. Some estimates also show a mid-sized data center commands the same water usage every day as a 1,000-household area, prompting concerns over the cost of water. Ray also frets over air quality, as the massive diesel generators that help power the data center's hardware send plumes of pollutants into the atmosphere. He and his neighbors tried to stop the development, but their efforts were largely unsuccessful. In September, the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors said all newly proposed data centers must adhere to stricter zoning rules, but the Plaza 500 project was exempt. I don't know how a general resident, even someone who has been engaging intently on an issue, has any chance to go up against the data center industry, Ray said the night the supervisors voted. For local governments, attracting data centers to their municipalities means a financial boon. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin said Virginia's data centers brought in $1 billion in tax revenue this year. With average-sized facilities, data centers offer a small number of direct jobs, often fewer than 100 positions. Google announced recently that its investment in nearby Loudoun County, which included two data centers, created about 150 direct jobs, a figure data center opponents say isn't worth the hassle. Data center advocates contend the number of indirect jobs like construction, technology support, and electrical work make the projects worthwhile. In that same announcement, Google said its investment created 2,730 indirect jobs. Kathy Smith, the vice chair of Fairfax County Board of Supervisors, voted in favor of the Plaza 500 proposal because, in her estimation, data center growth is inevitable in the region and Fairfax County should reap the benefits. "I have a responsibility to step back from what we do and look at the big picture," Smith said. "Data centers are not going away." On the other side of the country, in Morrow County, Oregon, Amazon Web Services built at least five data centers surrounding the 4,200-resident town of Boardman, nestled among vast stretches of farmland flecked with mint patches and wind turbines next to the Columbia River. Last year, AWS paid roughly $34 million in property taxes and fees stipulated in the agreements after receiving a $66 million tax break. Those payments, in addition to $1.7 million in charitable donations from the company in 2023, have been instrumental in updating infrastructure and bolstering services. This funding has gone toward new ladder, fire engine, a school, resource officer, and $5,000 grants for homebuyers, so far totaling at least $2.8 million. "This road right here wouldn't happen if it wasn't for AWS," said Boardman Mayor Paul Kiefer, riding in the passenger seat of a police chief, Rick Stoke Cruiser, and pointing out the window at construction workers shifting dirt and laying pavement. And we move on to the local and state page. Crazy Decatur led to gun charge. Tony Reed Decatur has this article. Stopped by police and asked why he was armed with an illegally owned 45 caliber handgun, Yansere A. Barbie said, "Decatur crazy," and quote, "I have it to have it," a sworn affidavit says. The 18-year-old defendant remains jailed after pleading not guilty to charges of armed violence, aggravated unlawful use of a gun, illegal possession of a weapon, and drug possession. A judge denied Barbie pretrial release on public safety grounds. His November 11th arrest began with an afternoon traffic stop by members of the Decatur Police Department's Community Action Team, which targets getting illegal weapons off the street. A department canine officer called Jester alerted to Barbie's vehicle after it was stopped at the intersection of Water and Sarah Gordo streets for having illegally tinted windows. A subsequent search of the vehicle turned up the gun and a plastic bag holding an ecstasy pill, according to the affidavit. Officer Jack Kaczynski, who signed the affidavit, noted that Barbie has had multiple run-ins with the Decatur Police Department dating back to when he was a juvenile. No convictions are listed, but Kaczynski said that the alleged offenses included the aggravated discharge of a gun and first-degree murder. Kaczynski also noted that a successful prosecution, now as an adult, could see the defendant sentenced to a minimum of 15 years in prison. Barbie pleaded not guilty to the offenses during a November 27th appearance in Macon County Circuit Court. He is due back for a pretrial hearing January 8th. Woman accused of torching car, Tony Reed, Decatur. Dashanel F. Hampton is accused of responding to being thrown out of a Decatur man's apartment by setting his rental vehicle on fire and destroying it. The 31-year-old man is quoted in a Decatur Police Department sworn affidavit as saying he had earlier been in a verbal dispute with Hampton, 26, although he did not say what the argument was about. That had ended with him, quote, removing Dashanel from the apartment, unquote, the affidavit said. He had then watched as Hampton had pulled her white Lincoln Sport utility vehicle up close by the rental Jeep Wrangler that was parked outside his apartment in the 500 block of South Church Street. The man stated he returned no more than 2 minutes later and observed the Jeep Wrangler was smoking heavily and engulfed in flames, the affidavit said. He said he observed Deschanel leaving the area in the white Lincoln. The man said that, given the short time frame involved, Hampton must have set the vehicle on fire. Responding police officers agreed with him. DPD officers observed the damage to the vehicle. The condition of the vehicle was beyond salvageable, the affidavit said. The hood of the vehicle was completely charred and black in color. The doors had been burnt off and or destroyed in the flames. Every tire was popped and destroyed. The trunk of the Jeep was also completely charred and black in color. The arson dates to September 12th, and police had found and arrested Hampton on October 25th. She appeared in Macon County Circuit Court on November 13th and pleaded not guilty to committing arson and criminal damage. Hampton has been granted pretrial release with the condition she stays away from the man involved. She was also ordered to stay away from Enterprise Rent-A-Car. The defendant is due back in court for a pretrial hearing, January 8th. And something you don't always see, but I will describe in her police file photo, she is smiling. All right, DUI crackdown nets 9 arrests. Tony Reed, Decatur, police involved in a crackdown on drunk and drug-impaired drivers made 9 DUI arrests in Decatur between November 22nd and December 2nd. A news release from Sergeant Steve Hagemeyer with the Decatur Police Department said there was also one arrest for electronic device use and 3 other traffic citations issued. The drive sober or get pulled over and click it or ticket effort involved officers working with other law enforcement agencies and was paid for with federal traffic safety funds. The initiatives target impaired driving while enforcing seatbelt use. We issue tickets to remind drivers and passengers that seatbelt use isn't a suggestion, it's the law, said Hagemeyer. This year's campaign was successful in grabbing people's attention with highly visible enforcement methods. As always, our goal is a safe community with safe drivers. Nation and world on A6, Assad flees after 13 years of war. Decades-long dynasty comes to an end amid bitter civil conflict. This article is by Zaina Karam and Abby Sewell, Beirut. Syrian President Bashar Assad fled the country Sunday, bringing to a dramatic close his 13-year struggle to hold on to control as his country fragmented into a brutal civil war that became a proxy battlefield for regional and international powers. The exit of Assad, 59, stood in stark contrast to his first months as Syria's unlikely president in 2000, when many hoped he would be a young reformer after 3 decades of his father's iron grip. At age 34, the Western-educated ophthalmologist appeared as a geeky, tech-savvy fan of computers with a gentle demeanor. But when faced with protests of his rule that erupted in March 2011, Assad turned to the brutal tactics of his father to crush dissent. As the uprising hemorrhaged into an outright civil war, he unleashed his military to blast opposition-held cities with support from allies Iran and Russia. The war has killed nearly 500,000 people and displaced half of the country's pre-war population of 23 million. International rights groups and prosecutors alleged widespread use of torture and extrajudicial killings in Syria's government-run detention centers. The conflict appeared to be frozen in recent years. And though Damascus remained under crippling Western sanctions, neighboring countries began to resign themselves to Assad's continued hold on power. In November, opposition groups in northwest Syria launched an offensive. Government forces quickly collapsed while Assad's allies, preoccupied by other conflicts, Russia's war in Ukraine and the wars between Israel and the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah and Hamas, appeared reluctant to forcefully intervene. Assad came to power in 2000, a twist of fate. His father cultivated Bashar's oldest brother, Basil, as his successor, but in 1994, Basil was killed in a car crash in Damascus. Bashar was brought home from his ophthalmology practice in London, put through military training, and elevated to the rank of colonel to establish his credentials so he could one day rule. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, December 10th, 2024. We'll take a break now and return with the second half hour.